Welcome to The Indigenous Approach, a podcast where we examine the role of the nation's premier partnered irregular warfare force across the competition continuum, from cooperation to conflict and everything in between.
Welcome to The Indigenous Approach podcast. I'm Major Dan Lessard, the host for today's episode. And today we've got an incredible story to share with you about two 18 Delta Special Forces medics who performed a double above-the-knee amputation on a surrendering ISIS-K fighter to save his life. So we're about to get to that story, but first I wanted to bring on our command surgeon, Colonel Jamie Riesberg, for some context and to help put the story into perspective. Colonel Riesberg, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Dan. Great to be here with you.
Sir, you listened to the recording of the episode. What stood out to you?
Oh, man. Well, first off, I think it's a great reminder of the incredible capability that our 18 Deltas and our Special Operations Combat Medics have from the day they leave the schoolhouse, but also how we refresh and keep those skills current through the refresher programs that are available. Very powerful reminder of that perishable medical skill set that's out there.
Sir, how common is it for 18 Deltas to perform that type of procedure?
Well, so I would say in the last 20 years of combat that we've all become familiar with in the CENTCOM AOR, this is certainly not common at all for soft medics to be doing this. And think about why that is. We built one of the greatest trauma systems probably ever in the history of military medical support. Phenomenal medevac, critical care transport, surgical teams all over the battlefield. So in reality, when we think about this last 20 years, the 18 Delta or the SOCA medic hasn't really had a chance to use the full toolbox in their repertoire. They haven't had a chance to do a lot of the things that they're trained to do for good reason, right? There were surgeons there. There was higher level medical capability. They were able to hand those patients off. But one of the things I love about this vignette is this is an example of where we're probably going in the future, right? And so we want to make soft medics great again. And these are some of those skill sets that are an example of that training and operating at the top of their game.
Yeah, a lot of talk about the golden hour, not really being a thing anymore. And so folks having those skills to kind of perform that, high-level austere care, prolonged field care. So you think it's gonna, this may be a portent of things gonna happen in the future, even though this happened in Afghanistan under the conditions that they were in with red air, et cetera.
Right, but again, as you know, MET-TC, right, the environment gets a vote, the enemy gets a vote, and I think in the future, we already move forward with the assumption we're not going to get air evac. So cases like this are probably gonna become more common.
For some of those folks that aren't medics, or SOCA medics or 18 Deltas, what are some of these opportunities that our folks get that maybe people don't realize, like the level of training that we put our folks through?
One of the first things to acknowledge is the base course that produces a special operations medic here at Fort Bragg is the Special Operations Combat Medic course. That's a 9-month, 40-week program of instruction that involves two clinical rotations. So they're doing some sick call and learning that. But more importantly, they get a month in a trauma center working alongside trauma surgeons, emergency physicians, and in the intensive care unit. So they are doing hands-on with really sick patients. What the story you're going to hear today is not the first time these medics have had blood on their gloves with a very sick patient. That's part of their training pipeline, is to build in them and prepare them for these types of scenarios. In addition, all of our medics are required every 2 years to come back to the schoolhouse and refresh. That 2-week refresher has been augmented recently by an additional week that refreshes many of the skills you're going to hear about today. So great examples of why it's so important to get these guys and gals back, and do their skills sustainment refreshers and training. And then finally, medical proficiency training. All of our medics are required every 4 years to go and spend a month back in the trauma centers or in a hospital. Again, working alongside surgeons, physicians, and making sure their skills are solid.
So, sir, a couple 18 Deltas on a forward operating base, kind of out in the middle of nowhere. They didn't just have an idea to amputate this ISIS fighter's legs, and just kind of sua sponte it. I mean, there had to be some kind of planning and pre-coordination that went into it, right? I think they talk about a little bit about that. What's your thoughts on what led to their success?
Yeah, the medics, the 18 Deltas do a great job of describing their environment, Dan. And I love that. As you listen to this story, just listen for some of these key words that help you visualize the situation they were in. They looked well in advance to talk to hire, talk to medical experts, had a coordinated plan, had some bailout procedures in mind if they couldn't do what they intended to do. But at the end of the day, I can't say it any better than either Travis or Blake said, I'm the best this patient is going to get right now. And that's the ethos. That's the mentality we love about our soft medics. So great job from the guys here planning, having an approach, sticking to their plan and adapting.
Well, hopefully we got our listeners' interest piqued. Sir, thanks for joining me to talk about this episode.
Thank you, Dan, and keep up the great work.
All right, well, let's get to this episode. It's my conversation with Travis and Blake on the Indigenous Approach.
All right, Travis and Blake, welcome to the Indigenous Approach podcast. We're happy to have you on the show today.
Yeah, thanks. Happy to be here. Happy to have a conversation with you.
Yep, same, Dan. Happy to be talking about this, even though it's been a few years. Good to refresh the memory here.
Yeah, well, it has been. Let me refresh it by reading just a small part. So, you know, our listeners will kind of understand already what this episode is going to be about. Let me just start by reading something from the journal submission that you all have submitted. In November 2020, a surrendering ISIS case supporter made his way to a special forces outpost in Afghanistan. He went through the detachment's established screening process and was moved to a nearby location for medical attention. Partner forces isolated him from the other surrendering ISIS personnel, allowing 18 Delta evaluation and consideration of further medical care due to the severity of his wounds. What that first paragraph doesn't explain, what the next one does in a little bit of medical kind of jargon, is this guy had part of his leg missing and some pretty severe wounds, and he was an ISIS K guy that came to your outpost. So help us understand what the situation really was, what was going through your mind when these guys show up to surrender, and specifically, you know, when this guy's coming in who's severely wounded.
Yeah, it was kind of an interesting scenario to be in because we'd been pretty busy up to this point. And then with the quote unquote collapse of the caliphate, they first started sending in all of their women and children through. So, you know, Blake and I identified a need to start separating people, because at that point, you know, we had people that were coming through that were obviously sick. And we had our support, our AI, attached infantry medics. Those guys worked their asses off during that period too. And they were doing a lot of the treatment with the women and children and doing that. And then they sent their elderly and their injured through. So that's when things started getting issues, or, you know, kind of.
Let me just ask. So you're saying this is November 2020. This is after, you know, you said ISIS fell, right? The caliphate fell. So folks were just showing up in droves. Is that right?
We had over 1,500 surrenders pass through our camp.
I think there's a lot of context that goes behind that too. Just to segue in real quick. One of the things that was really cool about this trip in particular was the prior teams had inhabited essentially a vacated area. The entire population groups had moved away because of the threat of ISIS in the area. And every team that came in before us continued to increase the security a little more. And we were just lucky enough that when we got there, that threshold had kind of come to be. And we were starting to see all these people moving back into the local villages. They started establishing themselves surrounding our base there. And when all these people started coming back to us, we had really established, because it's so cliche, but a really good rapport in the region. And with those women and children, they were just testing the waters. You know, they were really kind of experimenting how we would treat them, what we were going to do with them. And it was definitely a flood of people that we were not ready for initially.
We had another Afghan ODA come and support the current CANDAC ODA that we were working with to help facilitate these people. But yeah, I mean, over the course of 3.5, almost 4 weeks, we had over 1,500 what labeled themselves as ISIS surrenders. And that whole process, it politically sensitive because we can only do so much for them. And, you know, there's obviously things that need to be done when you have any sort of surrenders. They need to be processed. They need to be put into the system. So we can try to keep track of them and hand over that information to our our local counterparts, but we provided the immediate holding area. We processed everybody, any sort of initial medical needs. We had hired an Afghan doctor that did just your daily sick call medicine for them. But anything other than that, they were referred to the AI medics, who then came to Blake and I if there was anything that was a little bit more serious. So as the elderly and injured came through, like I was saying, that's when things started getting potentially a little sensitive, because now we have enemy combatants. Before, it was just women and children. Now we have, you know, guys who are identified as enemy combatants that are coming through asking for medical aid. So, of course, you know, we're not going to turn people away, especially while they're in our custody. So I think the first one was that guy who had the through and through upper thigh gunshot wound.
Yeah. Yep.
And he came through. And I, one of the questions that you had prepped us, sir, about kind of the ISIS beliefs and their background, how it, this could have affected them. It's very funny, because as I'm walking this guy back to the holding area, we gave him initial treatment, cleaned out the wounds, gave him some anti-inflammatory drugs and some pain medication, because he was going to be just processed through the Afghan channel up to whatever sort of prison system that they had for surrender facilitation. I was asking this guy through an interpreter. I was like, hey, you know, what would have happened if I would have showed up to your camp wounded? Like, would you have given me aid? And he started laughing, and I started, like, probably visibly showing signs of anger and contempt. You know, and we're walking down the hill, and he started laughing. He goes, yeah, absolutely. You know, we're all something along the lines, if we're all children of Allah, we would absolutely treat you. And the Turk looked at me. He said, he's lying. I said, yeah, I know. I know for sure. I said, you have my head on CNN, you know.
They may have amputated something, but not nice. That's great context. People are flowing in, and now you get to the point where it's kind of, you know, ISIS fighters. And this guy shows up, and he's, you know, I would guess severely wounded. So kind of how did that work? And what was the thought process kind of taken to lead up to it?
Blake was the first guy who had seen the patient from ours. Go ahead, Blake.
Yep. So I think, again, going, I hate to keep tying it back to the whole holistic approach of the deployment, but ISIS, because those people were coming in, ISIS was consistently targeting the local civilians who were freshly migrated into the region. And one of the things that we saw consistently, I mean, especially when we first got there, Travis, I don't know if you remember, it was once a week we would get, you know, these kids who had double and triple amputations from IED blasts. You know, you'd hear the blast and the kid would come in. So we had had a lot of experience with these types of injuries. We had a lot of experience that was fresh with our 68 whiskeys. And like we said, Travis and I, we've kind of played the game before and been doing this for a little while. So when this guy came in particular, he had been blown up about 2 weeks prior. And so when he came in, and he had what I initially thought were rags and shirts wrapped around his leg. And unknowingly, you know, as you kind of expose the wounds and you expose this injury, you realize that that 2 weeks might have been a little bit longer. The gangrene and the smell and just the condition of the wounds was about as bad as I've ever seen. It was an interesting sight for sure. One of the things that we did initially, just on presentation, you can tell that this guy was, this was a wound that was going to kill him in the very near future. He was sick. So to kind of establish how bad this thing was, one of the things that we had liked to do was use the EOD's X-ray machine to get some good imaging. So we could really take a good look at this. That allowed us to send it up the chain of command as we started seeking approvals later down the road. But, you know, I think Travis and I just kind of looked at each other for a while there and like, what are we going to do with this guy? We can't send him away. He's septic. He's going to die of infection, you know, in the very near future. And so fortunately, we had a really good chain of command. We had established confidence with us being able to do what we needed to do. And as those approvals started going up the chain and the realization that, you know, us doing the interventions that needed to happen became more and more realistic, I think there was a couple of wide-eyed stares like, oh, we're going to do this. So
for context, for this guy in particular, that day we had, like I said, this became a sensitive, this whole operation. Afghan news was there. There's like, we were seeing snippets of this whole surrender situation was being aired on U.S. news. So now we have this patient who we absolutely can't just shove away or hide somewhere else, right? Because we got this guy, all the other people now at the camp have seen this, you know, the guy without legs being carried in. So it was something that for sure needed to happen the right way. Usually what we had initially tried to do was take him to the next echelon of care. So we had a surgical team, located up in JBAT, up in Jaff. So we tried to do the air medevac, but for the 2 days that he was there, we had a 50-foot ceiling. It was just, crazy. I mean, literally 50-foot.
The rolling cloud cover was a real thing there.
No birds were going to come in. No birds were going to risk, especially for an enemy combatant flying through that to get to him. So that gave us the precedence and the urgency to start making moves to try to get this guy under the knife. So we called up, like Blake was saying, through our proper chain of command, medical chain of command, that is. So first, it all started with the team leader on the ground. He gave us a go-ahead to try to push it after we explained what was happening. We called up to our SOTF surgeon, and Doc Evans was up there as the PA, and he spoke highly on our behalf as he transferred us over to the CJ SOTF surgeon. That's where we met our first kind of roadblock. And if I'm a senior, this guy's a lieutenant colonel running the hospital at Bath, and hear about two 18 deltas out in the hinterlands trying to do any sort of amputation, I would probably say pump the fucking brakes too. Hold on, what's going on? We sat up with a teleconference with the seizure soda surgeon for a little over an hour and a half, and explained everything, and he was still hesitant even towards the end. But one of the last things he said was, I do not recommend that you guys do this. It is not my recommendation. However, you are the two on the ground. You are the one that ultimately responsible. You make the decision. Says, thank you, sir. Hung up the phone. I looked at Blake, and we came up with a timetable on which we wanted to start. And that's when the work began, prepping and getting everything ready for the surgery.
So how do you go about making I'm guessing a room in an aid station? Into a surgery room, a surgical room. How does that work?
It's in hindsight, it's one of those almost comical things, because in reality, it was a dirt hut. It was HESCO walls and a dirt floor. We were lucky enough to have the 68 Whiskies and kind of everybody on the entire base that was willing to help and wanting to help. At many times we had more hands than were needed, but they were gainfully employed. We used blue tarps, lined the entire OR suite that we had designated essentially with blue tarps, and done our best to maintain as clean of a situation as we could. It didn't take too long, actually. It was more the approvals that really took the time. And during that time, while Travis and I were working in the background, those guys were moving forward with everything just to be able to meet the timeline that really this guy really needed. Like I said before, he was septic. He was essentially going to die of infection in a very short period of time. He would have been dead by the time that he had arrived at his next stop along that evacuation chain, along the surrendery chain. So It was definitely a pressing issue, like Travis had said. So,
okay, so you get the room set, you get it all kind of cleaned up and to hopefully where it's wounds and everything stay clean when you're operating. What I saw some stuff in your paper. I mean, there was a power drill involved and kind of what did the actual operation, like, how long did it take? What did it kind of look like in non-medical jargon, maybe? Tell us about kind of what you had to do to kind of take care of this guy.
So after, like I said, the 68 Whiskies really busted their humps, getting everything ready for us and prepping. We deploy 18 deltas. When you get to a team, one of the first things that you kind of inventory is what's called a tax set, right? Your tax set and its original design, and we had the original design, as far as I know, the 2008 version, is for you to practice austere medicine. So you have a whole slew of surgical tools, you have a microscope, you have everything that you can imagine if you were a one or two man show trying to practice any sort of austere medicine, you know, for an extended field care situation. With that being said, there are certain limitations within that gear. You know, we're not necessarily set up to do a surgical bilateral above knee amputation. So we had to get kind of creative with some of our solutions. Then with that, you know, you had mentioned the power drill. Some of our equipment failed on us. We had to use non-medical equipment that was sterilized with hexachlorine, which is a very like harsh sterilizer that people use to scrub in for surgeries. So everything was as clean or sterile that you could want. I mean, we did it by the book as far as getting all of the tools and equipment ready. We scrubbed in. We called, you know, the start of the surgery, called that time. But altogether, it was about 7.5 hours. Blake ran anesthesia. So everything pretty much from the patient's chest up, which includes their breathing, which is a big thing when you put someone under any sort of anesthesia, maintaining blood pressure, keeping track of vitals, and then maintaining the patient on a surgical plane. Blake can go into the details of kind of how tricky it was because we didn't have the right drip sets. When I say drip sets, you imagine an IV bag that's filled with medication. There are certain drip sets that administer that medication or liquid, whatever you're putting through the drip set, at different rates. And surgical plane requires, if you're doing the math, especially with a limited amount of, you know, anesthetic drugs that we had, it gets kind of tricky when you don't have the right drip set. So Blake can talk about that portion of it.
All right. Yeah. So once everything had been approved, the OR was set, like Travis said, you know, we scrubbed in, we did our time out at the beginning, and I think we all just kind of looked at each other and realized, oh shit, here we go.
We're doing this.
Yeah, exactly. I think something that helped us big, Travis and I had done a lot of homework into this, you know, over the course of planning and prepping, over the course of the deployment. So both of us were pretty refreshed on what we needed to know going in. He had just finished an OR rotation where he had done this in the hospital prior to the deployment. So, you know, his skills were fresh. But essentially, once we got this guy on the table, one of the things that we're taught as 18 deltas as medics, you know, you don't want to take away that patient's airway unless you absolutely have to. So if you can keep them breathing on their own, you know, that's really the goal of anesthesia. One, you're going to use less medicine, which was a huge concern of ours, just the amount of medicine that we would need to keep them under for almost 8 hours. And two, when I don't have an entire anesthesiologist crash cart of meds in front of me, you know, I've got to be very sensitive as to where I keep this guy. And so without going into too much detail, like you said, the medical jargon, one of the things that I think really made a difference, we did an anatomic regional block. And so essentially I went in and I numbed his nerves on his legs, his sciatic and femoral nerves, and just kind of flooded that whole area. And that allowed us to be able to essentially say, you know, you don't feel anything from your leg, from your hip down. At that point, the pain management was minimal and it was more just focused on the anesthesia. In total, he received about 22 different medications from his prophylactic antibiotics, or the antibiotics he received, you know, while he was awake, all the way through the end of his care, to include, you know, the ibuprofen that I gave him as he walked away. Like Travis said, I think the surgical plane was something he and I were pretty worried about. You know, if he's waking up, if he's coming to, then and moving his leg, then Travis and the other guys down there can't cut the way they need to. And so I minimized my interruptions as much as I could, all things considered. But at the end of the day, he never had a tube down his throat. He was breathing on his own the entire time. He and I had a dance for sure. If you look at the vitals trending, it's a constant ebb and flow as different things were done to his legs, as different things happened to the patient. But I was gainfully employed running his medications that whole 8 hours.
Yeah. Wow.
From the chest down, you know, we tried to treat this as close to you would within our clean setting as we would in an OR, as far as trying to maintain sterility and being as clean as we could. Now, like Blake said, we had a slew of antibiotics, which I'm sure is what ultimately really helped this guy at the back end of the surgery and why he survived. But scrub the patient down, put in a catheter so that we could kind of keep track of the fluids as they're coming in. You need to be able to track if they're coming out or how fast they're coming out. And that helps with a lot of things. So catheter, Blake was able to keep track of the urine output, you know, how much this guy was peeing during the whole procedure, and was able to balance that with some other augmentating fluids and stuff that he did. Catheter was in, scrubbed the patient. The first leg was the right leg, and that was the leg with his entire tibia and fibula, which are, you know, the two bones below your knee that typically would connect to your foot if you had a foot there, which he didn't, were completely exposed. We talk about gangrene, you know, it's a very serious infection, and there's a smell, and you could legitimately, if you stood to the side of the patient, you could see the off-gassing of this infection. So imagine, you know, you see the mirage, the heat mirage coming off of a pavement, or if you spill gas, you can see the fumes. That was happening with this guy's leg. It was that bad. I think his initial temperature was 104.7, you know, so that's right at that threshold where your brain starts cooking inside your head. So it needed to happen. One of the other SF medics that assisted, a guy from our AOB, he put on two tourniquets as high up on the leg as he could, which allowed kind of freedom of manipulation as we're doing hindsight, something I brought up in my AR with our JSOM, our Joint Special Operations Medical Training Center, is that patient positioning for something like this is key. You know, we were limited. We had pretty much a litter, which a Talon litter, which is the ones that you unfold and everything that you usually carry in trucks. And then we just had the litter stands. So the entire surgery, I'm kind of hunched over trying to do this. And it was very uncomfortable for me to try to do that this time. But what made a difference was the ability to freely manipulate the patient without worrying about those tourniquets coming undone. So I had guys moving the leg for me as I was doing the transection of the different muscle groups. And, you know, we're taught in the course how to do amputations. And like Blake said, I had just done a medical proficiency training at Madigan and had assisted on one. So the big question that right at the start is what we're going to do after we amputate the leg. And what I mean by that is, are we going to close it? When I say close, I mean actually take the skin and close it around, you know, the amputation itself, or leave it open. And this is an area that we've had some deep discussions about. And armchair quarterbacks will say, you know, you should have done this, you should have done that, and, you know, perfect world. Sure. You know, but we were living in a very imperfect scene. So
to capitalize on that real quick, Travis, I remember picking him up from where he was staying with our Afghan counterparts. And when we picked him up for the surgery, he was covered in blankets that were piss blankets.
Yeah.
And, you know, here's this guy about to go into surgery and he's wrapped up and bundled up in piss blankets. So that those kinds of things definitely play into the decision of how we are going to send this guy off. You know, so
it got, without getting too much into, like you said, sort of the surgical jargon, got to the point where we're ready to actually start cutting through the bone. We cut through the femur and we're able to kind of smooth the edges of the bone, which is more for patient comfort than anything. You know, we're trying not to do the old Civil War, just hacksaw and just leave a big open, look like a transection of a ham or something, right? So what you do is you cut the skin and you leave enough skin for closure so that you can suture it around. Being in that hospital training prior, I drilled in some burr holes in the back of his femur just to try to attach some of the muscle groups using the tendons that are attached to them, just so he would have some sort of movement. Because if you don't, you know, your muscles are attached to tendons, which are attached to other muscles, and they're also attached, the ligaments attached bone to bone, tendons, muscle to bone. Without that being attached, now you just have a stump and you can't move your leg. You know, there's no way that he could have done anything. So I did that, attached, and then I made the decision to close, and I sutured in a drain. And what a drain does is, as your body is healing, there's a lot of different material, waste byproducts and things that come out of a fresh wound like that, that need to not be in there. The drain lets all that come out. So anyway, if you look at the picture, it ended up looking pretty good. I mean, the closure, and afterwards, it's like, damn, you know, that really worked out pretty well. Yeah. But after that the first leg took a while because he had some interesting anatomy as I was going through. The second leg was faster. So after the first leg, took about a 20-minute break and then started prepping the other leg. Now, the other leg we haven't talked about is he had this big open compound fracture. It was also gangrenous, right? So open fracture of the two bones underneath the knee, your tibia and fibula. Both were broken, big, nasty wound. So originally I wanted to do a below knee for that, but as I'm cutting into the tissue, I'm just looking for viable tissue. It's just good tissue that I know will be, you know, will still have a blood flow to it at the end of the surgery. So I kept having to inch my way up, and that one ended up being another above knee. The second leg got a little interesting. So as I was transecting through the muscle groups, I hit a huge pocket of just a big cyst. And it looked like canola oil that's coming out of this guy. It was pretty gross. So I had a maneuver around that and clean that up. But overall, the second one went a lot smoother because I was a lot more familiar with the anatomy after doing the first leg. And the second closure worked out just as well. We have some pretty cool AR videos where you can see the ligation. And when I say ligation, you're literally tying off blood vessels and nerves. And one of those blood vessels is your big femoral artery, which anybody seen Black Hawk Down, they know from that one scene, that's how that young ranger died, because they couldn't clamp that femoral artery. Well, you wrap silk sutures around it, and it's just a thread, and you tie it off, and that makes it so your artery doesn't bleed anymore. We have a very cool video of that artery after we released tourniquets pulsating, showing that we had good hemorrhage control or blood control. But closed up the second leg, medics and scrubbed him down, cleaned him up one more time. And just briefly, I'll talk about the decision to close and why I did it. Once the Afghans left our care, they went through the Afghan channel of prisoner transfer, surrender transfer. That was not a dependable sort of, vehicle, I guess you could say. Ultimately, depending on what was assessed after interviewing each surrender, they were probably sent to different places. And that is just a speculation because honestly, we don't know where a lot of them went. So I knew that this guy probably wasn't going to get a whole lot of after post-op care. I don't think people were going to worry about doing dressing changes for this guy. I don't think they were worried about keeping things clean. So the thought was big open wound, avenue for infection, stuff can get in there. Right? Because who knows how long these wraps are going to stay on his leg. We were told that the next time he'd be able to see a doctor would be at least 10 days. A lot can happen in 10 days, especially when you're being transferred in the back of jingle trucks and everything as a prisoner. So we had talked about it, and that's ultimately what led to the decision to close. Put in the drainage valve, just with his heavy antibiotics that Blake gave him and the other post-op medication, we just figured that would lower the likelihood of any more foreign kind of dirt or anything getting in those wounds. So that's ultimately what led to the decision for us to sew everything back up.
Like I had said, we had kind of pre-allocated medications. What was a big thing for us because we were, you know, this is an active combat zone, and we still needed to maintain meds for the team, for our partner forces and everything like that, to be able to give care. And this guy, in 8.5 hours of 8.5 hours of anesthesia, this guy chewed through the majority of that. And so we were lucky, skilled, maybe a little mix of the two with Travis and all the guys who were down there cutting, that they were able to finish right as we kind of hit that limit. On, all right, I can't give this guy any more meds. We really need to reserve the rest for us. So he did a great job getting it done and getting it done as quickly as he could too.
I do want to ask, as part of your paper talks about the telemedicine consult and guidance, you know, in my head, I imagined, somebody holding a VTC camera up to a surgeon that was in BAF or like somebody on the phone with these guys. Was that happening? Like, what was that kind of guidance as you were talking about these decisions on how to go about this? What kind of guidance were you getting in real time?
So it wasn't necessarily real time. Like I said, we part of that getting the clearance from our medical chain of command, we had to explain what we wanted to do. We had to give the plan. So as especially from the CJSOTA surgeon's point of view, we needed to let him know that we were competent medics. I mean, like you said, we talked before we started the podcast, Blake and I collectively probably had the most experience as 18 Deltas in country at that time. So we went over what we planned to do. The seizure surgeon and our SOTA surgeons talked about anatomy. And I mean, we're literally sitting there with, you know, our guidebooks that show the anatomy of, you know, the lower extremities and talking through each part of the procedure that we were planning step by step and exactly how we were going to do it. And then they were throwing in questions, you know, okay, what if you come across this? What's your plan? What if you come across this? So it really helped because we had a legit, at least on my end, a legit surgical plan kind of going into it that I could adjust right or left if I needed to.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. So it wasn't like somebody talking you through every step of the way type thing. Pretty much doing this on your own once it got started.
Yeah, we were autonomous once that first IV went in, we were on our own.
Let me ask you this. You talk about an almost 8-hour procedure. How do you stay mentally in the game the whole time and such a tedious thing that takes all your kind of mental energy, physical energy? Talk us through that.
Being in firefights, you get this adrenaline dump. This whole procedure, everything that happened with this, the stars aligned. I mean, this is a once in a lifetime kind of opportunity for two 18 Deltas that are, you know, out there as pretty much as far as we can get to the edge of the country doing this. So that there was definitely kind of an excitement, like, holy shit, this is a big deal. We're about to do, I don't think anybody's ever done a bilateral above knee or any sort of bilat amputation in a field setting. So that was kind of a motivation, like, okay, we got to do this and we got to do it right. Because this is either going to be, we're going to come out of this looking great, or we're going to come out of it looking like a couple of asshats that potentially killed a guy. So we really stayed focused. And being able to talk and constantly kind of bounce each other's ideas back and forth with each other about what we're doing also was a big thing that kept us in the game.
We started, I believe, at right around 9 p.m., 2100, and we finished early morning. So, you know, we didn't sleep that night. It was the surgery ran through the course of the evening and into the night. And I don't think Travis or I realized it was 8 hours until we kind of sat down afterwards and just looked at each other and say, you know, did that really happen? We were gainful. Yeah. Like I said, we were busy. There was always something going on. There wasn't really time to realize how tired you were. Just like Travis said, you know, when you're in a firefight, you've got so much going on, your brain's just going, and it's not until after it all kind of comes and catches up with you.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. So you, in the paper, you're talking about following up with this guy, what, a week or two later? How was he doing, one, and two, could he say anything to you?
All right. So because he was EPW, we did not talk directly to the patient. The people that were in custody of that guy pretty much told us, like, yeah, he's alive. He's here. You know, everything seems fine. We're going to transfer him to, I think, the equivalent of the local national intelligence agency. Like, they have their own hospital. That's where he was going to get sent, just because he was kind of a high profile guy. What really made me feel good is we talked. I mean, we did this in November. I got an outbrief in January from a surgeon at that hospital that ended up receiving the guy. The guy was still alive. He was in custody. They had gone in. They had opened up sutures. I think he told me they had cut like another half inch off of each femur and then closed him. So he was alive 2 months later. And that local the local guy kept referring to me as doctor. You know, yeah, I appreciate it. But no, this, you know, but yes, sir. He up to 2 months later, that guy was still not necessarily kicking. He was flipping, but he was there.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear. I with a couple minutes left here in the episode, I want to ask, we've heard you said you were some of the most experienced 18 Deltas. You had previous OR experience right before the deployment. What are some of those things that kind of really prepared you for this? I know you talked about some of those things already, but what is one or two things that made you feel confident enough to tell these the leaders above you, the surgical leaders and the doctors and folks, that you could do this? And then that just to yourself, like, hey, I got this.
Definitely the hospital training, but even going through the course. I mean, there are certain parts of the course that are always under fire. Different training methodology that we use at the course that is, you know, you can't substitute. So the way that the SF medical course was ran when I went through, just being able to, I mean, I haven't gone to the schoolhouse. I graduated the course in 2010, and every 2 years, you know, we had to do our SOCMIS rotations. But the schoolhouse does an incredible job of maintaining relevancy with what's going on real world. And there, I mean, at the schoolhouse, you do certain things, you know, you do amputations and training on different training aids that, like I said, can't be substituted, but sets you up for success on the far end of the surgical side. And then even, you know, Blake can talk about the anesthesia stuff that we talk about now and the refreshers. I think it was implemental in us being confident to be able to do this.
Absolutely. Like I said, those regional blocks that I did on his femoral and sciatic nerves, I've done those on humans before. I've had those done on me before. That's one of the ways that we train. And so that gives me a large sense of confidence going into it. And I think I would say 100% the schoolhouse is to give credit to for the success. The other thing is experience. I think Travis and I have both been doing this for a long time, and we have, at a certain point, you kind of realize, you know, I'm the best this guy's going to get. I'm going to try my best, and that's how I'm going to sleep at night, is at least doing my best across the board. And you do so many of them at a certain point in time, you know, they don't always work out. You don't save everybody, but when you do, it validates. And when you don't, you learn something new and you continue moving forward. So I'd say the schoolhouse and the experience for me were those two things that kind of brought us to the end there.
Yeah. What, you know, for somebody that might be listening to this episode that is not an 18 Delta, maybe he kind of introspects a little bit hearing this, who makes a good 18 Delta? Like who do y'all want kind of following in your footsteps? Like what kind of people?
So to me, there are two in my career, we've come across two different types of medics, guys who live and breathe it, who are super passionate about it. Blake was that guy. Blake in his free time would read, you know, medical journals and stuff like that. And then guys, me, who don't live and breathe it, but because and it just, again, speaks about the level of training that we get. You know, I was able to, with my aversion to being a medic for the longest time, and now I'm a team starter, so it's awesome. But the aversion, still, I was able to get in there and knock something like this out. And with that, medics go two different paths. You know, Blake is going to be a doctor. Blake's on his way. He's working to try to get his package turned in to be a provider. And I went more of the SF route and wanted to be a team sergeant. But the only thing I can say about the 18 Delta MOS that's very unique to it, and my dad was an 18 Delta, and he said the same thing, and that's kind of why I wanted to be it, is that an 18 Delta can be cross-trained in 80% of the MOS tasks. So Bravo task, Charlie task, even Echo task. But there is no way that we have enough time in the team room to train the other MOSs up to be 80% of what we are as 18 Deltas. There's just too much. There's just, the knowledge base is too wide. So that's a unique thing. As a guy or a gal nowadays, looking at potentially trying to go down the 18 Delta pipeline, you come out of it, you know that you are the most trained in your MOS, in your specialty, than any other MOS within the regiment.
I would say humility goes a long way as well. You got to, and that's, I think that's across the board for special forces in general. You have to be willing to learn from your mistakes. You've got to be willing to admit that you're wrong or admit that you don't know what's going on, and be able to make those phone calls to the CJSOTA surgeon and say, hey, you know, we're comfortable and confident, but what are we missing? To be able to look at each other and kind of war game it out, in whether it be mission planning or amputation planning, it goes a long way to just kind of take a step back and be able to listen to what other people have to say.
Very cool. Well, I assume that you're submitting this this journal submission, this article about kind of like an AAR on this event to help make others better. Is there anything you want to say quickly to any of the other 18 Deltas out in the force?
before I made E8, I had to do SOCWIS, and I presented this case, and Blake was at the refresher class before me. And the only thing I can say is that, you know, this is one of those things that coming out of the course, you're like, yeah, okay, never going to happen, right? Never going to happen. Well, it did. And all the training that we went through, is sometimes the monotonous courses that you sit through, the death by PowerPoint, it's all worth it. Stay the course. And if you're interested in medicine, stick with it, because who knows, the next opportunity, something big like this might come out. Yeah.
Yeah. The preparation piece was huge. Just being ready, willing and able when that opportunity presented itself. It can be, oftentimes it can be frustrating working with SOTF surgeons, and SOTF or CJSOTF surgeons, and your medical chain of command, your administrative chain of command, your direct chain of command. There's so many people that have so much say in what you do and what you can't do, but every now and then those stars align, and then it's on you to be ready. Yeah.
That Lieutenant Colonel at the CJ SOTF, did he say anything to you afterwards after he said he didn't recommend you do it?
No. We had some surgeons who I think were upset that they didn't get to do it at JAF call and ask us, you know, why is this happening? Blah, blah, blah. And respectfully, you know, we listened to them and explained everything. And then they kind of backed off. But at the end of it, it's like, hey, you know, you guys aren't in our chain of command. We don't have to go through you for any sort of decision. Like, we went through the SOTF and the CJ SOTF. But no, we never spoke to that officer. And I think he might've been a full bird. So if he's out there listening, I apologize. I think it was a full bird there back at the time.
Okay. Well, hey, what did we miss? Is there anything that we didn't get to?
I was going to say that our care for these guys who came in and surrendered, I have pictures of Travis holding babies when they came in. It's one of my favorite pictures that I show everybody all the time. You know, the women and children, the way we cared for them, the way we just took care of them, we're good people to them. And these, the old men and the injured ones that came in behind them, you know, just caring for them and taking care of them. I think it did a lot more than just sending him away alive. I think it put in, you can't argue that, you can't be dissuaded that, yeah, they might not be here for the right reasons. You can have all your thoughts on that, but these are good people. These people are the ones who, you know, save kids, who take care of guys who were shooting at them weeks prior. It does a lot for that region, for the impression of the United States on these peoples as a whole. And that was really satisfying for me whenever I left Afghanistan.
Well, I couldn't have asked for anybody to say it better than that. Well, look, gentlemen, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on the Indigenous Approach podcast to just kind of share your story. And, you know, I can't wait to get this episode out for folks to hear. Thanks again for joining me.
All right, sir. Thanks for having us.
This has been the Indigenous Approach. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Follow us on social media. And if you have suggestions for topics or guests, send us a message. Thank you for listening.